Usually when we look at a dashboard, whether you're driving a car down the highway or sitting in the cockpit of a commercial airliner, there's this fundamental unspoken trust.
Right.
You trust that the instruments are telling you the truth about your actual survival. Like if the fuel gauge says you have half a tank, you trust you aren't just going to fall out of the sky.
Yeah, exactly. It's a total reliance on metrics. I
Yeah.
mean, we trust the numbers to be this objective binary reflection of reality.
But imagine you're flying a plane and the dashboard in front of you is just glowing beautifully green. The altitude looks fantastic. Your airspeed is phenomenal. And the engine efficiency metrics are literally off the charts.
Sounds like a great flight.
Right. But then you happen to glance out the little window next to you and the wings of the plane are completely engulfed in flames.
Wow. Yeah.
The flight computer is cheerfully ignoring the fire because it simply wasn't programmed to measure the structural integrity of the wings.
It only has sensors for speed and fuel.
Exactly. It's optimizing for a very specific metric while the plane is actively disintegrating around you.
And that terrifying disconnect is exactly what we're tearing into today. Because, we have politicians and economists celebrating record high GDPs, roaring stock markets, and unprecedented technological efficiency.
All the time.
But at the exact same time, life expectancy in many developed nations is actually dropping. Ecosystems are collapsing, and people are more burnt out and isolated than ever. So today, we're looking at a diagnostic framework that explains exactly why our societal dashboard is lying to us.
Yeah, we are jumping into a really profound deep dive today. We're looking at a comprehensive academic white paper dated May 31st, 2026. It's titled Life Coherent Politics: From Power Struggle to the Governance of Shared Life Capacity,
It's a mouthful, but it's brilliant.
authored by Dr. Bechara Sahili. And this paper attempts to completely rewire how we view governance from the absolute ground up.
And what makes this paper so compelling for you listening right now is that it doesn't just pull from one narrow, dusty corner of political science.
No, not at all.
It's drawing on some incredibly heavy-hitting thinkers from vastly different fields. You have Humberto Maturana's work in the biology of cognition.
Which is huge.
Yeah. And Eleanor Ostrom's Nobel Prize-winning research on commons governance, plus Amartya Sen's theories in welfare economics.
When you cross those traditional boundaries, when you take the raw biology of what a human being actually needs to survive, and you smash it together with economic systems and political philosophy, you arrive at a very different way of looking at power.
You really do. You stop looking at the ideological labels on the outside of a system, and you start looking at the actual lived experience of survival.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because framing this as a dry academic critique of politics does it a huge disservice. Reading through these pages, it feels much more like a survival manual for the 21st century.
It really is a survival manual.
It's asking us to step entirely outside the daily noise of partisan bickering. We are leaving the standard left-wing versus right-wing talking points completely at the door for this deep dive.
And that's what's so fascinating here. The paper bypasses traditional political ideology entirely. I mean, we spend so much time arguing over whether the state should control more or if the free market should control more.
Right, the endless debate.
But Dr. Sally is asking a much more primal question. Does a political order protect, repair, and expand the conditions of life?
Because before you can have a voting citizen or a digital consumer or a factory worker, you have to have a living, breathing being.
Exactly. If the political order is destroying the conditions for that being to live, then all those ideological debates on cable news are essentially happening on a sinking ship.
Which brings us to how Dr. Sahli diagnoses the disease we are currently dealing with. He gives it a very specific, evocative name, which is life-blind politics.
Life-blind politics refers to any system that is organized around categories of perception that can easily register things like money, votes, and legal authority.
The easy stuff to put on a spreadsheet.
Right. But they completely fail to register the degradation of life capacity itself.
Think about how a government operates today. I mean, they can measure a fiscal deficit down to the very last cent.
Oh, absolutely.
They have massive spreadsheets, whole departments, and complex algorithms tracking every penny of tax revenue. But they have zero capacity to measure a trust deficit in a local community.
Yeah, or they can't measure the utter exhaustion of unpaid family caregivers because there is no cell on the spreadsheet for that.
The author makes a brilliant distinction here between system maintenance and life maintenance.
Yes, system maintenance is simply keeping the institutions running. The elections happen on schedule, the municipal budgets are passed, the stock market opens at 9:30 a.m. and closes at 4:00 p.m.
The system is maintained.
The system is maintained, but life maintenance asks an entirely different question. Is the operation of those institutions actually protecting the living capacity of people and ecosystems?
You can have a society that is flawlessly maintaining its systems while its people are simultaneously getting sicker, more isolated, and, you know, more precarious.
We see this all the time. I mean, a hospital might be executing perfect system maintenance, maximizing patient turnover, minimizing the time a bed sits empty, hitting all its financial targets for the quarter.
Looking great on paper.
Looking fantastic.
Ooh.
But if the nurses are so burnt out they are quitting the profession entirely, and patients are being discharged before they are fully healed just to clear the bed, the life maintenance of that institution is failing completely.
That perfectly illustrates what the paper calls the Great Inversion. This is one of the most chilling concepts in the whole text for me.
It really shifts your perspective.
In a healthy, coherent society, systems are built to serve life. Like, the economy was invented to feed and provision people. The legal system was invented to protect people.
Right.
But in our current inverted order, life is required to serve the systems.
Human beings are literally expected to serve the economy. Ecosystems don't exist in their own right. They exist only to serve extraction for industrial growth.
And the most visceral symptom of this great inversion is the normalization of what the paper calls sacrifice zones.
Yeah, that's a heavy term.
I want to pause on this term because it really stuck with me. When we hear sacrifice zone, we usually think of it geographically, right?
We do. We think of Cancer Alley in Louisiana, or a low-income neighborhood that gets bulldozed to build a highway interchange.
Or a town placed right next to a toxic chemical plant so the rest of the country can have cheap consumer goods.
Right. It's a place we have quietly agreed to destroy so the rest of the machine can keep running. But the paper expands this to human sacrifice zones as well.
Like individuals as sacrifice zones.
Exactly. The exhausted, unpaid caregiver looking after an elderly parent with dementia while trying to hold down a full-time job, that person is a sacrifice zone.
Oh, wow.
Or the precarious gig worker driving for 3 different apps with 0 safety net, sleeping in their car between shifts. That person is a sacrifice zone.
So the system uses these people as a sort of moral technology.
They absorb the harm, which allows the wider system to continue functioning smoothly and profitably by concentrating the structural damage somewhere else.
It's like we've built this highly advanced, incredibly fast car, but instead of the car taking us where we want to go, we are literally throwing our own bodies into the engine furnace just to keep the car moving forward.
That's a grim analogy, but yeah, it's accurate.
But here's the piece I struggle with. How do these systems convince us that this sacrifice is normal? Why do we, as a society, just accept that whole neighborhoods should be polluted? Or that it's totally normal for young professionals to burn out and have heart palpitations before they hit 30?
Well, look at the language we use to justify it. It connects directly to the concept of realism as it's dissected in the text. Whenever systems demand severe sacrifice from life, they always justify it by calling it being realistic.
Oh, absolutely. It's just the cost of doing business.
We have to be realistic about the economy, which usually translates to we have to accept that these factory workers will lose their pensions.
Or we have to accept that this old growth forest must be clear cut to meet quarterly earnings.
Exactly. And the author argues that this is a false realism.
Yeah.
It is nothing more than system loyalty disguised as hard-nosed pragmatism.
Because true realism would have to begin with the real conditions by which life continues.
Right.
If your economic policy or your political ideology requires the destruction of the biosphere or the mass abandonment of vulnerable people, it isn't realistic at all. It's essentially a suicide pact in slow motion.
The paper urges you, the listener, to constantly question what is actually being preserved when a politician or a CEO tells you to be realistic.
What metric is being saved?
What metric is being saved? And at whose physical life cost is that preservation happening?
And just to reiterate, this isn't a critique unique to free market capitalism.
Yeah.
No, not at all. The paper is incredibly impartial on this front. I mean, a centrally planned socialist state bureaucracy can demand horrific sacrifice from its citizens in the name of ideological purity or national security just as easily as a free market can demand sacrifice in the name of shareholder value.
Yeah, the functional critique here applies to any system that prioritizes its own dashboard metrics over human and ecological viability. If the system is blind to life, the ideological label pasted on the outside of the building doesn't matter to the person or the ecosystem being consumed.
So If this great inversion forces life to serve the system, the mechanism it uses to enforce that rule isn't always obvious.
It's rarely obvious.
It's not always a man with a gun or a physical threat. Sometimes it's a deeply hidden pattern suppression of capacity. And this brings us to how the paper redefines two massive fundamental concepts, politics and violence. Let's start with politics. Dr. Saley refers to politics as world conservation. What does that actually mean?
Usually we think of politics as a series of isolated decisions, passing a law, allocating a budget, tweaking an algorithm. But the paper argues that these policies don't just solve isolated problems, they actively conserve worlds.
Worlds.
Yeah, and a world, in this context, is a patterned field of human relations.
So a policy isn't just a rule you have to follow, it creates a specific flavor of reality. Can you give an example of that?
Sure. Let's look at a punitive welfare system.
Yeah.
If you want to get food assistance, maybe you have to submit to drug testing, fill out 100 pages of highly intrusive forms, prove you are applying for a certain number of jobs every week.
And wait in line for hours at a fluorescent lit government office.
Exactly. That policy doesn't just distribute food. It conserves a world where need is inherently suspected. It trains everyone in that society to view poverty as a borderline criminal act.
Oh, I see. Or alternatively, an extractive economy conserves a world where the earth is viewed purely as a warehouse of dead inputs waiting to be turned into commodities. Every single policy we pass conserves a specific way of relating to one another.
Which leads directly into their redefinition of violence, drawing heavily on the Norwegian sociologist Johan Galtung.
The paper states that violence is any pattern world that suppresses life capacity.
Yes. Galtung broke this down into three distinct layers. First, you have direct violence.
That's the visible stuff. Assault, war, police brutality, domestic abuse. It's a physical wound with a clear perpetrator.
And in most political discourse, our definition of violence stops right there. If nobody is throwing a punch or dropping a bomb, we say there is peace. But the paper pushes us into the second layer, which is structural violence.
Structural violence.
This is harm that is built directly into the ordinary, legal, everyday functioning of a society.
So things like housing markets that price people into homelessness.
Exactly. Or labor laws that enforce poverty wages and education systems funded by local property taxes that predictably distribute vulnerability and suffering in a highly unequal way.
And then the third layer is cultural violence.
Right. These are the narratives, the media tropes, and the ideologies that make the structural harm seem perfectly reasonable. It's the story we tell ourselves.
Like viewing poverty as a personal moral failure instead of a systemic design flaw.
Or viewing the destruction of the Amazon rainforest as necessary economic progress.
Mm-hmm.
Cultural violence is the story that justifies the structural violence.
Cultural violence is the anesthetic. It's what allows structural violence to operate every single day without the entire population revolting.
He nailed it.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me, and I want to push back on this because I think a lot of people listening will have this exact reaction.
Go for it.
I struggle with expanding the word violence this far. Let's say a person is denied access to clean water, or they get sick from pollution, but they aren't poisoned by a cartoon villain dumping sludge in their well.
Right.
They are suffering because of an invisible, highly complex web of historical zoning laws, municipal pricing matrices, and bureaucratic inertia. Is it really fair to call that violence? Doesn't the word violence inherently require intent? Like, if a city planner makes a spreadsheet error that underfunds a water treatment plant, that's terrible incompetence, but is it violence in the same way manslaughter is?
That is the most common pushback to Galtung's work, and it makes total sense from a legal perspective.
Mm.
The law is heavily focused on intent and culpability. But the author unpacks this brilliantly by asking us to shift our perspective. From the perspective of the life ground, from the perspective of the physical body experiencing the deprivation, the intent of the bureaucrat is entirely irrelevant.
The body still goes without water. The child still develops asthma.
The child's lung capacity has been permanently suppressed. If a system predictably, reliably, and statistically produces shortened lives, chronic sickness, and despair for a specific demographic, it is violently suppressing life capacity.
Even if no one meant to do it.
It does not matter if every single person involved in that system was perfectly polite, meant well, and followed all the administrative rules. If the patterned result is deprivation, it is a form of violence. Think of a poorly designed highway intersection that causes 10 fatal crashes a year.
Right.
After a certain point, those aren't accidents. The structure of the intersection itself is producing the harm.
And this profoundly redefines our concept of peace, because peace is usually just defined as nobody is shooting at each other right now.
That's what Galtung calls negative peace, the mere absence of direct violence. But the paper argues we have to aim for positive peace.
Positive peace.
If violence is the suppression of life capacity, then peace is the active, deliberate organization of life-supporting conditions. You cannot have peace while structural violence is starving a community or working people to death, even if the streets are perfectly quiet and the crime rate is zero.
Wow. Okay, so if structural violence is the invisible bureaucratic mechanism that suppresses life capacity, what is the infrastructure that actually nurtures it? If the system is broken, what is the antidote?
The paper calls this antidote the civil commons, and it is rooted deeply in what we touched on earlier, which is the life ground.
We need to define the life ground clearly because it anchors the rest of the paper.
The life ground encompasses all the natural, social, and cultural conditions required for living beings to not just exist, but to flourish. It is obviously clean air, potable water, and nutrient-dense food.
The basic.
But it is also social trust, the time and physical capacity for care, and a sense of cultural meaning. It's the absolute bedrock of human existence.
And the civil commons are the shared institutions and resources that a society builds to protect that life ground.
And crucially, they protect it without subordinating it to private profit or arbitrary domination.
So we are talking about universal healthcare systems, public libraries, ecological protection agencies, public transit, and even the shared intangible trust required for a democracy to function.
The paper leans heavily on Eleanor Ostrom's theories here. For those who don't know, she won the Nobel Prize in Economics for proving that the tragedy of the commons isn't an inevitable law of nature.
We are usually taught this very stubborn false binary. Either the government has to control everything through top-down state command, or corporations have to control everything through privatized free markets. Because if you just leave a resource to the people, a pasture, a fishery, a forest, they will selfishly destroy it.
But Ostrom spent her life studying actual communities. From lobster fishers in Maine, to farmers sharing irrigation systems in Nepal, to villagers managing alpine pastures in Switzerland. And she proved that communities can and do successfully govern shared resources over centuries without destroying them.
Provided they have the right design principles.
Exactly. They don't need a CEO or a dictator. They can manage the commons themselves.
So the commons aren't just some tragic utopian leftover from medieval farming villages. The paper argues they are the foundation of any viable future. But conventional economics treats the civil commons terribly.
Oh, terribly. Huh. Conventional macroeconomics routinely misclassifies the civil commons as a cost, a drain, or a burden on the system.
Right. When we fund schools or healthcare, it's labeled welfare spending and targeted for austerity cuts.
Meanwhile, highly extractive sectors, industries that might literally be clear-cutting forests or polluting the water table are viewed as wealth-producing because they generate rapid GDP growth. We measure the wealth of the extraction, but we don't measure the poverty created by the destruction of the life ground.
I was thinking about this, and the analogy that came to mind is that the civil commons acts exactly like the immune system of a human body.
Oh, I'd love that.
You really don't notice it when it's working perfectly. You might even resent the energy it takes to maintain it. Like, why am I paying taxes for a library I don't use? Or why do we have these annoying environmental regulations?
Right.
But the second that immune system is compromised, the whole body crashes. Every other function, including the precious economy, grinds to a halt. We saw that vividly during the early days of the global pandemic.
That analogy is incredibly apt. Think about what happens when you degrade an immune system. This explains why the paper views austerity measures as incredibly dangerous.
Austerity meaning when a government slashes public budgets, cutting healthcare funding, closing fire stations, reducing environmental oversight, defunding public transit, usually to balance a budget or appease international creditors.
Precisely. When a system implements austerity, it is effectively dismantling its own civil commons.
Yeah.
And according to this framework, austerity is a direct, undeniable form of structural violence. Because the human need doesn't magically disappear just because the budget was cut.
Right. If you cut funding for elder care, the elderly people don't stop needing care.
The strain is simply transferred. It is transferred off the state's official spreadsheet and directly onto the physical bodies of citizens.
Wow.
It gets transferred onto exhausted, mostly female family members who now have to provide informal care. It gets transferred onto future generations who inherit crumbling infrastructure and a hotter climate. The political maturity of a society, therefore, isn't measured by how big its GDP is or how many billionaires it mints.
It is measured entirely by the health, depth, and resilience of its civil commons. But let's play devil's advocate here, because it is very easy to sit in the studio and say, we should protect the life ground, we should fully fund the civil commons, libraries for everyone.
Sounds wonderful.
It does. But we live in a physical world of finite resources, hard ecological boundaries, and competing human needs. We don't have infinite money, we don't have infinite land, and we certainly don't have infinite carbon budget left. How does this life-coherent framework actually deal with scarcity and conflict?
That brings us to one of the most practical, visually striking models in the paper. It's called the safe and just political space.
Okay, let's break that down.
This idea merges two massive concepts. First, you have Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum's capabilities approach. This defines the social foundation, the absolute baseline of resources and rights every human needs to live a dignified life.
And it merges that with the ecological ceiling frameworks, like planetary boundaries and Kate Raworth's donut economics.
Imagine a donut. The inner hole of the donut represents the social foundation. Water, food, political voice, housing, education. No one should be allowed to fall into that hole, because that is severe deprivation.
Right.
But the outer crust of the donut represents the ecological ceiling. Climate change, biodiversity loss, ocean acidification, freshwater withdrawals. Society cannot shoot past that outer crust without destabilizing the Earth's life support systems.
So the entire goal of a life-coherent government is to keep society living in the sweet spot, the actual dough of the donut.
You got it. You cannot meet the social foundation by burning so much cheap fossil fuel that you shatter the ecological ceiling. But conversely, you cannot protect the ecological ceiling by implementing extreme eco-austerity policies that force the poorest people in your society to freeze in the winter or starve.
Dropping them straight into the hole of the donut. But what happens when you hit a wall? The paper calls these tragic choices. These are situations where a society faces an emergency and literally every available option carries a massive, serious cost to the life ground. There is no win-win.
This is where the paper proves it is grounded in reality, not a utopian fantasy. It acknowledges that tragedy and severe scarcity are real. For instance, climate adaptation is going to require some agonizing choices.
Like what?
Well, a historic, low-lying coastal community might have to face painful, forced relocation because the seawalls are no longer viable. Or think of pandemic restrictions. Shutting down the economy saves lives from a virus, but it simultaneously devastates local livelihoods, creating a massive spike in poverty and mental health crises.
So how do you navigate a tragic choice coherently? If someone has to get hurt, how do we decide?
Dr. Sali outlines specific principles of tragic choice, four of them. First, you must prioritize the life ground above all else. You protect basic survival before you protect luxury, profit, or convenience. Second, you must ensure burden fairness. This is huge. The people with the least power and the thinnest margins should never be the ones forced to bear the heaviest sacrifice. If a neighborhood has to be relocated, you don't start with the poorest neighborhood just because the land is cheaper.
Third, it says you must truthfully name the harm.
No political euphemisms. Don't call the destruction of a working-class neighborhood urban renewal or slum clearance. Name the loss. Acknowledge the pain.
And finally, you must build in an obligation for material repair. If the state must impose harm for the greater good, the state is morally obligated to plan and fund how to heal that specific harm.
It's about accountability.
I have to push back on one of the principles the paper mentions here, which is the idea of demanding real participation during these tragic choices. It argues that affected communities must have a voice in the decision. But practically speaking, if a tidal wave is coming, or a critical ecological threshold is crossed overnight, or a novel virus is ripping through a city, we literally do not have time to organize a town hall meeting. We can't put a 30-day public comment period on a screaming emergency. How can we demand deep democratic participation when speed is the only thing that saves lives?
That is a very realistic challenge. If the building is on fire, you don't take a vote on which exit to use. Someone just needs to grab a megaphone and give orders.
Exactly.
And the author validates that. There are moments where rapid, top-down, coordinated action is strictly required. But Dr. Sahili makes a crucial historical clarification. Emergency authority must remain strictly bounded, highly transparent, and rigorously time-limited.
The danger is the old political adage, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Look at history. The great danger is when a crisis is used to make emergency dictatorial powers a permanent method of rule. Think of post-9/11 surveillance laws that were meant to be temporary but became permanent fixtures of the state.
Yeah, they never go away.
Furthermore, the paper argues that even under severe time constraints, participation isn't a luxury. It improves perception.
What do you mean by that? How does participation improve perception in an emergency?
Say a distant technocrat in a capital city is looking at a satellite map during a massive flood. They decide, purely based on topography, to build an emergency flood wall in a specific spot.
Okay.
But the local community living on that river could tell them instantly that building the wall there will funnel the floodwaters directly into the region's only hospital.
Oh, wow.
Distant decision makers, no matter how smart, constantly miss downstream consequences. Participation gives you the hyperlocal data you actually need to survive the tragic choice without causing unnecessary secondary disasters.
Okay, so now that we've deeply explored the philosophy and the models, we understand the great inversion, we see the donut, we know what the civil commons is, how do we actually use this? Like, if I'm a local city council member or a policymaker or even just a voter looking at a complicated ballot proposition, how do I practically test if a law or a budget is life coherent?
This is my favorite part of the paper, because it provides a very rigorous, highly applicable diagnostic toolkit. It starts with what Dr. Seeley calls the sevenfold diagnostic grammar.
The sevenfold diagnostic grammar.
It is a set of seven distinct lenses you have to look through to evaluate any system, policy, or institution.
Let's walk through them, and let's actually ground them in reality. Number one is constraint.
Constraint asks us to look at limits. Every system has limits.
Hmm.
But it asks us to distinguish between real limits and imposed limits.
What's the difference?
A real limit is ecological. There's only a finite amount of fresh water in this local aquifer. You cannot negotiate with the aquifer.
Right.
An imposed limit is a colonial debt structure that forces a developing nation to underfund its healthcare system to pay exorbitant interest rates to foreign banks. A life-coherent policy fiercely respects real ecological constraints, but it challenges and dismantles artificial, imposed constraints that suppress life.
Number two is margin. This is the buffer. It's the reserves of social trust, public health, and ecological resilience that allow a system to absorb a shock. Life-blind politics views all margin as an inefficiency that needs to be cut to save money.
Exactly.
I look at this concept, and I immediately think of how modern supply chains operate.
The just-in-time model.
Exactly. A massive corporation holds zero inventory in a warehouse because storing things costs money. They rely on algorithms and global shipping networks to deliver a specific part to the assembly line the exact minute it is needed. It's highly profitable.
Right up until a single ship gets stuck sideways in the Suez Canal.
Or a pandemic hits, and then the entire global economy instantly stops. It feels like we have taken that zero inventory business model and ruthlessly applied it to human beings.
Think about how we run human lives now. We are running with zero inventory for rest, zero inventory for sickness, zero inventory for caregiving.
And we praise people for it. We call it efficiency or hustle or grind culture. If you aren't perfectly optimized, you're falling behind.
Take that just-in-time supply chain analogy and apply it to a hospital. When you eliminate margin, systems become incredibly dangerously brittle.
Yeah.
What looks to an administrator like a highly efficient hospital running at 100% capacity with no empty beds, or an efficient school maximizing student-to-teacher ratios at 35-1, is actually a system running entirely on the unpaid, invisible exhaustion of its workers.
Because there's no buffer.
Right. If a mild flu season hits, that efficient hospital collapses into total chaos because it had zero margin to absorb the disturbance. It was consuming human margin to hit a financial metric. Life-coherent politics treats margin rest, redundancy, biodiversity, institutional slack as a vital political good. Margin is the very architecture of resilience.
Number three in the grammar is state. This doesn't mean the government. It means the actual lived condition of the field. What is the actual state of the people? Not just what the stock market says, but are children actually nourished? Are caregivers supported? Is the soil healthy?
And then number four is disturbance. These are the shocks to the system. A financial crash, a massive storm, a strike.
How does the system handle it?
A life-coherent system learns from the disturbance. It asks what invisible precarity was just exposed. A life-blind system just tries to force everyone back to the fragile normal as fast as possible without changing anything.
Think at the 2008 financial crash. It was a massive disturbance that revealed deep structural rot. But instead of repairing the life ground, the system mostly just bailed out the banks and forced everyone back into the same precarious housing market.
Exactly. They didn't learn.
Number five is perception. What is a society trained to notice and what is it trained to ignore? Do we obsessively measure stock buybacks and quarterly profits, but completely ignore the rate of topsoil erosion or the rise in teen anxiety?
We manage what we measure.
Number six is regulation. In this biological context, regulation means feedback loops. It's the ability of a system to feel pain.
Yes. Does the society have ways to correct harm once it's detected? If a new policy causes massive suffering, can the community signal that pain? And will the institution alter its course?
Or does the institution just deploy police to punish the community for protesting?
Exactly. And finally, number seven, options. This is about real pathways, not just formal legal permission, but actual material viability.
Right. Like a society might tell you that you have the legal option to start your own business or change careers.
But if you have zero capital, your healthcare is tied strictly to your current employer, and you are paying exorbitant rent just to survive.
That option is a ghost. It's an illusion. Life coherent politics ensures that options are materially supported.
And from this grammar, the paper's appendix provides a practical life coherence test. It's a series of questions you can apply to any policy. Whose necessities are enclosed by this law? What margins are consumed? And if harm is produced, what material repair is built in?
If every local city council applied those three questions to every zoning law or budget cut, our lived reality would transform overnight.
It really would.
But that leads to the obvious cynical question. If we have this incredible toolkit, if we have the sevenfold grammar and the life coherence test, why can't we just show this to everyone, agree to implement it, and fix the system?
Because, as the paper points out in its next major section, our shared reality has shattered.
Yeah.
You cannot implement a shared test if you do not inhabit a shared world. We have to address the elephant in the room, polarization and the total collapse of how we consume and verify knowledge.
Dr. Sanwi calls this the epistemic commons, epistemic relating to knowledge. It's the shared conditions that allow a society to seek, test, and correct knowledge together. It's the infrastructure of truth.
It's robust investigative journalism, peer-reviewed science, public libraries, transparent government data, and even just local community memory.
And over the last two decades, that epistemic commons has been intentionally enclosed, defunded, and polluted. And when the epistemic commons collapses, it doesn't just leave a neutral vacuum. It gets aggressively filled by manufactured ignorance and attention capture.
This is where we have to look closely at our digital platforms.
The algorithms.
The algorithms that curate our social media feeds are fundamentally optimized for outrage. Why? Because outrage and fear keep your eyes glued to the screen, which generates more ad revenue.
The algorithm isn't designed to find the truth or to build consensus or to explain nuance.
No. It operates using highly sophisticated A/B testing and dopamine loops to find your deepest fears, confirm your worst biases, and amplify them.
I read a study recently about how the simple design of a retweet or share button fundamentally altered human behavior. It removed the friction of communication. Suddenly, sharing a highly inflammatory, unverified rumor took zero effort and yielded massive social reward in the form of likes and engagement.
The architecture of the platform actively incentivizes the destruction of nuance.
Which leads to how the paper redefines polarization. We usually think of polarization as just extreme political disagreement, but the author argues that disagreement is actually healthy. Disagreement clarifies values.
Real polarization is something much darker. The paper calls it mutual world denial.
Mutual world denial.
It's when you no longer see your political opponent as a fellow citizen you disagree with, but as an existential threat to reality itself. It's when you believe the other side is so deeply evil or brainwashed that you cannot share a world with them. Their total erasure becomes your only acceptable political goal.
That is a chilling but terrifyingly accurate description of how a lot of political discourse feels right now. It's not about policy anymore. It's about existential survival against the other.
And the author's prescription for this is what they call participatory repair. It's a deliberate, forceful move away from the idea of just being polite.
It completely rejects the shallow calls for civility we hear all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, let me bring up a highly relatable point here. When politicians or television pundits tell people to just be nice or we need to reach across the aisle and listen to the other side, it often feels completely insulting. It feels like putting a Band-Aid on a compound fracture.
It really does.
If one side feels the other is literally destroying their life, ground stripping their rights, poisoning their water or destroying their economic future, isn't this paper just asking for an impossible utopian vision of handholding?
That is exactly why the author rejects shallow civility. Civility without justice is just a way to preserve the harm, but ask people to use their inside voices while doing it.
Please politely allow me to ruin your ecosystem.
Right. Stop yelling while we foreclose on your house. Participatory repair requires material repair.
Material repair.
You cannot fix polarization just by tweaking the moderation settings on a social media app or having a nice cup of coffee with your neighbor. You have to fix the underlying economic precarity, the regional abandonment, and the structural humiliation that make those polarizing, hateful narratives so rewarding to people in the first place.
People retreat into tribal outrage when their life ground is insecure. When you feel like you are drowning, you look for someone to blame.
If you want to rebuild a shared reality, you have to do it through shared problem solving on concrete physical issues. You don't put bitterly divided people in a room to debate high-level ideology or identity politics. That will just lead to screaming.
Like, so do you do?
You put them in a room or out in the field to figure out how to fix the local watershed together. You organize them to fight a predatory landlord together. The shared physical work builds shared trust. And that shared trust is what rebuilds the epistemic commons.
So, to bring this entire massive framework home, the final section of the paper looks at how life-coherent politics physically alters the reality of the massive institutions you interact with every day. Let's look at three specific areas: law, economics, and the digital world. Let's start with law and this fascinating concept of constitutional life guardianship.
Usually, our legal systems are obsessed with control, property rights, and procedural correctness. But a life-coherent legal system must be fundamentally about repair and protection. The Constitution shouldn't just limit tyranny in the present moment. It must actively guard the life ground for future generations.
Because future generations are the ultimate disenfranchised group. They will inherit the consequences of our carbon emissions and our resource extraction, but they cannot currently vote.
This fundamentally redefines the concept of sovereignty. Sovereignty is no longer the absolute right of a nation-state to do whatever it wants within its borders, including destroying its own environment. Sovereignty becomes stewardship within a nested, interdependent planetary system.
But practically speaking, how does constitutional life guardianship actually work? If future generations get a seat at the table, what does that look like in a modern democracy? Do we literally appoint a secretary of the future who sits in cabinet meetings?
It's not as far-fetched as it sounds, and the paper highlights several practical mechanisms that are already being tested around the world. It suggests mandatory long-term ecological impact assessments for all major legislation conducted by independent scientific bodies.
Okay.
But more radically, it proposes formal youth councils.
Like teenagers.
Yes. Councils of young people who are legally granted veto or delay power over long-term irreversible resource extraction projects. Imagine a mining corporation wants to level a mountain. The local youth council would have the legal authority to pause that project and force a deeper life capacity review.
I can already hear the political fallout of that. You're letting a bunch of 16-year-olds stop economic progress. But when you think about it, the 16-year-old is the one who will have to live with the poisoned groundwater for the next 70 years, long after the CEO has retired and the politicians are dead.
It changes the power dynamic entirely. The paper also suggests ecological trust funds legally bound to future generations, where the core capital cannot be touched, only the sustainable yield. The core idea running through all of this is that legal rights must be seen as life capacity protections.
Meaning what exactly? Break that down for me.
Meaning that freedom of speech isn't just an abstract legal claim we debate in law schools. It functionally exists to protect the epistemic commons. The right to housing functionally protects family life, physical safety, and childhood development. The rights written on a piece of paper are completely, utterly meaningless if the material and ecological conditions required to exercise them have been destroyed.
You can't exercise your right to free speech if your city is permanently underwater. You can't exercise your right to vote if you are starving to death.
The life ground is the prerequisite for all other rights.
Which flows perfectly into the second application, political economy. We have to fundamentally distinguish between two things, money value and life value.
This is the crux of reversing the great inversion we talked about at the beginning. In our current system, money value is simply exchangeability. It's price. If someone is willing to pay for it, it has money value.
Okay, and life value.
Life value, on the other hand, is the actual tangible contribution an activity makes to the life capacity of a community.
So, to use an extreme example, a high-frequency trading algorithm that rapidly speculates on global food commodities, generates massive money value for a hedge fund. It creates billions in wealth, but it actively degrades life value because it artificially drives up the cost of basic staples, making bread unaffordable for poor families.
Exactly. Or look at the flip side. A kindergarten teacher, or a stay-at-home parent caring for a severely disabled relative, or a community garden organizer, they are generating immense, unquantifiable life value. They are literally building the resilience and capacity of the next generation.
But the economic system registers them as generating very little to zero money value.
We pay hedge fund managers millions, and we pay early childhood educators poverty wages.
A life-coherent economy aligns the two. It structurally rewards activities that provision life and aggressively penalizes or taxes activities that extract from it.
And finally, let's look at digital life. Because digital platforms aren't just novelties or simple websites anymore. They are the primary environments where modern human life is organized. They are the new town square, the new marketplace, and the new neighborhood.
The paper argues that human attention must be legally recognized as a civil commons. Just like clean air or a freshwater aquifer, our collective ability to focus, to think deeply, to reflect, and to relate to one another is a shared vital resource.
And right now, technology companies are treating that commons the same way 19th century timber barons treated the forests, clear-cutting it for profit.
Under a life-coherent framework, technology companies must be required to justify their platforms before life. The diagnostic question isn't just, is it legal or is it profitable?
The question is, does this platform protect human autonomy and social connection, or is its underlying business model wholly reliant on converting human relationships, psychological vulnerabilities, and outrage into monetized engagement?
If it's the latter, it is extracting from the life ground just as violently as a strip mine extracts coal.
It is such a profound shift in perspective. Once you grasp this framework, it really does make you look at every news headline, every app on your phone, every corporate earnings report, and every policy debate through a completely different lens.
It takes the dashboard we've been blindly, obediently trusting, unplugs it, and asks us to actually look out the window at the real physical world we are creating.
Exactly.
And that brings us to the end of our epic deep dive into Dr. Sekely's white paper. You've explored the terrifying reality of the Great Inversion, where we are actively asked to serve the systems that were supposedly built to serve us. You've seen how violence must be redefined not just as a physical blow, but as the invisible bureaucratic structures that predictably suppress human capacity.
We've mapped out the civil and epistemic commons, the vital immune system, and the shared mind of our society.
And you've learned the sevenfold diagnostic grammar to rigorously test whether the power structures around you are truly serving life, or if life is merely being consumed to serve power.
It is a framework that absolutely refuses to offer easy utopian answers. But it offers the right questions. It asks us to mature politically, to face tragic choices with a commitment to fairness, and to prioritize material repair over cheap ideological victories.
Because politics isn't just a spectator sport. It isn't just something that happens in distant Capitol buildings or on cable news networks while you watch from the couch. It is the active daily art of conserving the world you live in right now.
Beautifully said.
And I want to leave you with a final lingering thought based on this source material. Tomorrow, when you wake up, take a hard look at your own workplace. Look at your local community, your child's school, or even just the digital platform you are scrolling through right now. Ask yourself, what world is this specific environment actively conserving? Is it a world of dignity, margins, and repair? And more importantly, if that system is running smoothly and efficiently today,
whose margin, whose hidden exhaustion, whose harvested attention, or whose degraded environment is being consumed right now to keep that world running?
Because once you see the life ground, you truly can't unsee it. And you realize that true realism isn't passively accepting the destruction of life for the sake of the system. True realism is demanding with everything you have that the system answer to life. Remember that glowing green dashboard in the plummeting airplane? Don't trust the metrics if the wings are on fire. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep your eyes open, fiercely protect your margins, and demand a politics that is finally coherent with life.